illness and will include discussion and interactive exercises, plus support and connection among peers.
You deputize the National Guard to carry out immigration enforcement, and then you also deploy the military to the southern border.
President-elect Trump has picked Tom Homan to serve as border czar in his incoming administration.
Today is Monday, November 11th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Candidates backed by the cryptocurrency industry won big on Election Day. What does that mean for everyone else?
The United States will be the crypto capital of the planet and the Bitcoin superpower of the world, and we'll get it done.
And on this Veterans Day, we visit a North Carolina coffee shop that's become a gathering place for veterans in need of company.
Not only for me personally, but a lot of veterans would probably not be here today if it hadn't been for this coffee shop.
Those stories coming up in this hour of All Things Considered after these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President-elect Trump is starting to flesh out his second administration and is expected to name Stephen Miller as the White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports Miller would play a big role in drafting and implementing Trump's immigration agenda.
Stephen Miller will work closely with Susie Wiles, who was just named as the next White House Chief of Staff. Vice President-elect J.D. Vance referred to the selection of Miller as, quote, another fantastic pick. Miller, who served as senior advisor in the first Trump administration, is best known for his role as a key architect of some of the Trump administration's strongest immigration plans. Once leaving the White House, Miller went on to start America First Legal, a nonprofit that aimed to serve as a conservative version of the ACLU. It worked with conservative lawyers who filed hundreds of lawsuits and legal demands on behalf of conservative causes and against Democrats. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Haiti's transitional government has decided to oust the prime minister and appoint a new one. But NPR's Ada Peralta reports the prime minister says they don't have the authority to fire him.
Haiti's transitional council was already adrift. They had control of a Kenyan-led security force, but lacking in legitimacy and facing accusations of corruption, they were paralyzed, unable to fight the gangs that have taken control of most of Port-au-Prince. Over the weekend, the majority of the council voted to oust Prime Minister Gary Conille. In an open letter, Conille says the Constitution allows only Parliament to fire the Prime Minister. And at the moment, Haiti has no Parliament. Conille adds that the agreement that brought the Transitional Council to power allows the Council to appoint but not remove a Prime Minister. No matter how this resolves, what's clear is that it plunges a country already in chaos closer to anarchy. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
On this Veterans Day, President Biden and Vice President Harris laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington National Cemetery, just outside Washington, D.C.
This is the last time I will stand here at Arlington as Commander-in-Chief. It's been the greatest honor of my life to lead you, to serve you, to care for you, to defend you, just as you defended us generation after generation after generation.
Biden also told the group gathered that the Veterans Administration is expanding the types of cancers covered under the PACT Act, legislation he signed to expand health care services for vets who served at military bases where waves of toxic smoke rose from burn pits that incinerated garbage and other waste. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Florida Department of Education released a list of over 700 books over the weekend that were removed or discontinued from districts throughout the state in the last school year. That's an increase of almost 400 books from a year before. Central Florida Public Media's Daniel Pryor has more.
Among the list of books removed last year are classics like Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut and newer favorites like Looking for Alaska by John Green. Florida Freedom to Read Project Director Stefana Farrell calls the list an undercount, but she says she's worried removing the books hurts classroom teaching.
A lot of them removed many, many books, including classic literature and literature that regularly appears on the AP exams and prepares our students for college-level coursework. We're removing all of these books.
Governor Ron DeSantis says the state of Florida is not banning books, but removing titles that are, quote, pornographic and inappropriate for kids. For NPR News, I'm Danielle Pryor in Orlando.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, is under pressure to resign. This after an investigation found that the head of the Church of England failed to inform police about serial physical and sexual abuse by a volunteer at Christian summer camps as soon as he became aware of it. Some members of the General Synod, the Church's National Assembly, started a petition calling on him to step down, saying he has lost the confidence of his clergy. U.S. futures contracts are trading flat. Wall Street higher by the closing bell. The Dow up 304 points. The Nasdaq up 11. S&P 500 up 5. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Plans are underway for Happy Dancing Turtle's 19th annual Back to Basics event on February 15th. They are looking for presenters and vendors who are passionate about sustainable living. Proposals are due by November 15th. Find more at happydancingturtle.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. President-elect Donald Trump's administration is starting to take shape. Tom Homan will serve in a position that Trump is calling border czar, and he's expected to tap longtime advisor Stephen Miller for the role of deputy chief of staff for policy. Neither of these positions needs Senate confirmation, but both men would play roles in defining immigration policy, including executing Trump's vision for unprecedented mass deportations. NPR immigration correspondent Jasmine Garst joins us now. Hey there.
Hi.
So, Jasmine, let's start off with border czar. What can you tell us about Tom Homan and his track record and what we might expect from him?
So Homan started off leading removal operations at Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, during the Obama administration, which oversaw a record number of deportations. Trump named him acting director of ICE pretty early on in his last administration, and he was one of the architects of the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy, which was when thousands of families were separated at the border. That policy was extremely controversial. Eventually, it was rescinded by the Justice Department. About 1,000 children have still not been reunited with their parents.
Right. And Trump was elected on a platform that promised these mass deportations of undocumented immigrants. Homan would oversee that. Do we have any sense of how that might happen or what he might do there?
It's not clear yet what mass deportations would look like. What Homan has said is that he would target criminals and national security threats first and then seek to deport non-criminals. Here's Homan at this year's Republican National Convention.
To the millions of illegal aliens that Joe Biden's released in our country in violation of federal law, you better start packing now.
So Homan has said that he will revive large-scale immigration arrests at workplaces, which is something that the Biden administration discontinued, and that those arrests are not just about coming down on folks undercutting U.S. workers. It's also about helping solve human trafficking cases. Now, Homan has been asked if he would do family separation again, and he said he would deport families together in a humane way, but this would present really serious issues, considering that 10.6 million American citizens live in a mixed immigration status family.
Right. Jasmine, I want to turn quickly, if we can, to another position, and that's Deputy Chief of Staff. Tell us how Stephen Miller could affect immigration policy.
So Miller was the senior advisor to Trump during his first administration, and immigration has been his main policy focus. Again, no concrete plans have been revealed, but Miller has advocated for what he and Trump allies are saying will be the largest deportation in U.S. history. Here he is at this year's Conservative Political Action Committee conference.
You deputize the National Guard to carry out immigration enforcement, and then you also deploy the
military to the southern border, not just with a mission to observe, but with an impedance and denial mission.
So, as with many Trump proposals, it's unclear how much of this they could legally do. But what is clear is that immigration, mass deportations will be front and center next year.
NPR's Jasmine Garst, thank you.
Thank you.
Millions of federal student loan borrowers are facing more uncertainty after last week's election. President Biden will leave office with big parts of his student loan agenda stuck in the courts, and Donald Trump has been actively hostile to the idea of loan forgiveness. To explain what this all means for borrowers, NPR's Corey Turner is here in the studio. Hey, Corey.
Hey, Ari.
There have been so many lawsuits around Biden's student loan proposals. Where do things stand right now as Trump prepares to take office?
Yeah, it can be a little confusing. We all know that Biden's biggest effort at loan forgiveness was rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court, which said he had clearly exceeded his legal authority. But there are a few smaller efforts that are right now in various stages of limbo. So one would erase any interest that is accrued for borrowers who owe more now than they did when they first took out their loan. It's technically a rule, but it was paused by the courts before it could actually be finished, which means it's likely going to fall to the Trump administration to decide its fate. And there is another proposal that would provide loan forgiveness to people in extreme financial hardship, like folks caring for a loved one, for example. Now, we don't know for sure how the next administration would handle these pending efforts, but Trump has been pretty clear for many years now about how much he dislikes the idea of loan forgiveness. And polls show that so do many Republicans. So it's pretty hard to imagine at this point the Trump administration moving forward with any of these.
And what about the Biden administration's SAVE plan, which is also tied up in the courts?
Yeah, for me, this is maybe the biggest and most interesting question mark, Ari, because SAVE is essentially a repayment plan, but it is so generous, offering a fast track to loan forgiveness, that it too was challenged in court by Republican state attorneys general. And the courts paused it. The thing is, though, that millions of people enrolled in SAVE, and they're in a kind of limbo, not being asked to make payments while the courts sort out whether or not their plan is legal. It's not clear how the Trump administration is going to handle all of these borrowers if, or presumably when, the SAVE plan disappears. It might need to go through a whole new rulemaking process to create some kind of new, less generous repayment plan. There is one older income-based plan that has not been challenged and does still offer limited loan forgiveness. It's called IBR, and it's still around because it was created by Congress, and it will be around unless Congress decides to change it.
What about all of the people who have received loan forgiveness? Is there any chance they could be back on the hook for the loans that were forgiven once Trump takes over?
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to forget among all of these lawsuits that President Biden still provided loan forgiveness to roughly 5 million Americans. I don't have any reason to believe at this point that that debt relief can be undone. Biden's few successes over the past few years really did come largely by expanding access to pre-existing congressionally approved programs, which gives them a kind of strength that his other efforts don't have. For example, offering forgiveness to folks who work 10 years in public service or who struggle with a severe disability. Can those programs be shut down? Yes, but it seems unlikely. You know, during his first term, Trump tried to eliminate public service loan forgiveness, but he didn't because that requires Congress. Now, lawmakers could vote to end PSLF, but it's not clear they have any desire to.
What are the bigger lessons here from the Biden administration's efforts at loan forgiveness?
Yeah, that's what I've been thinking a lot about this, Ari. One for me is governments have a finite amount of energy. And so when they choose to do one thing, they're also choosing not to do other things. I have a bunch of conversations with higher ed experts, not all of them conservatives, who say, look, by going all in on loan forgiveness and doing it without Congress, the Biden administration missed a real chance to meaningfully expand access to college. And they're disappointed by that.
It's NPR education correspondent Corey Turner. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This year will likely be the hottest on record. That news came today as the United Nations Conference on Climate Change got started in Baku, Azerbaijan. But a big topic at this year's meeting is the U.S. election results and how a second Trump administration could hinder global climate efforts. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
This UN climate meeting started like most others.
Welcome to Azerbaijan. Welcome to COP29.
This is the 29th Conference of Parties, called COP29. Conference President Mukhtar Babayev encouraged cooperation because he said climate change is here.
From flooded homes in Spain to forest fires in Australia, from rising oceans in the Pacific to barren plains in East Africa. Whether you see them or not, people are suffering in the shadows.
To avoid even worse catastrophes in the future, countries agreed in 2015 to drastically cut greenhouse gas emissions from burning fossil fuels. The U.S. and other wealthy countries agreed to reduce emissions the fastest and help compensate developing nations, which did little to contribute to the problem. But scientists say the world is off track to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 Fahrenheit. Now, President-elect Trump, who called climate change a hoax, vows to once again exit what's known as the Paris Agreement. In Baku today, President Biden's top climate advisor, John Podesta, tried to be optimistic.
Are we facing new headwinds? Absolutely. But will we revert back to the energy system of the 1950s? No way.
Podesta says the U.S. energy transition is underway, with tens of billions of dollars already allocated, much of it in Republican congressional districts. But that's just here in the U.S. This meeting in Azerbaijan was dubbed the Finance COP because the goal is to get rich nations to fulfill their obligations to developing countries. Negotiators worry that any deal the U.S. agrees to now might not be valid after Trump takes office in January. There's talk of other countries taking on larger roles. The European Union and China are most often mentioned. Still, that doesn't mean the U.S. can escape responsibility, says Mohamed Adao with the climate group PowerShift Africa.
Ultimately, no one can run from the climate crisis, not even Donald Trump. You know, the whole world is facing extreme weather events. Economies and livelihoods are being wrecked.
Economies and livelihoods are being wrecked, Adao says, and there's little time to waste. COP29 will last for at least 2 weeks in Baku, and participants say despite the U.S. election overshadowing these negotiations, they're still optimistic for a positive outcome. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXC KBXC. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXC KBXC news team. Support comes from Timberlake Lodge in Grand Rapids, offering an endless soup and salad bar for lunch and burgers and hand-cut steaks for dinner. Online at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Center Stage Minnesota celebrates the talents of Minnesota musicians Fridays at 2 and 10 p.m. with Malachi Coons. Find interviews with Minnesota artists like Cornbread Harris, Davina and the Vagabonds, and more. And we receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota Certified Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. The AARP Tax Aid Program is seeking volunteers to help seniors and people with modest incomes to prepare their income taxes in the new year. Volunteers are especially needed in the Grand Rapids and Bemidji areas. Training is provided, and all new volunteers will have a mentor to help guide them. For more information, visit aarpfoundation.org/taxaid. That's aid with an E at the end. United Way of 1000 Lakes is teaming up with restaurants in Itasca County for Dining United, now through November 21st. Each restaurant will give a portion of their proceeds to United Way. Find complete details at uwlakes.org. Programming is supported by the Northland Foundation, granting nonprofits, assisting small business, and supporting capacity building. Also offering early childhood youth and aging programs in Northeast Minnesota. NorthlandFDN.org. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Insperity, providing HR services and technology from payroll, benefits, and HR compliance to talent development. Learn more at Insperity.com/HR Matters. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In the final days of the campaign season, both major party candidates visited Reading, Pennsylvania, which is home to a large Latino population. Carmen Russell Sluchansky of member station WHYY returned to Reading to check in with voters about what they hope to see in the next Trump administration.
Joseph Nunez is tired but elated. He talks about coming down from an adrenaline rush after the election. This is the first time he's had a weekend to enjoy with his kids after spending most of his free time campaigning for Donald Trump.
You happy to see me today? Did you miss Daddy while he was working? Yes? A little or a lot? How much is a lot? Not enough to divert their attention from Paw Patrol.
Nunez is sitting in his mobile office, an executive coach that he used to take other volunteers to canvass Latino neighborhoods around Reading. His girls are watching TV.
I feel like a winner. I feel like we won the Olympics. Like we finally got a gold medal. Like this is actually not just a fairy tale. This actually really happened.
Nunez, who is Dominican American, takes some credit for a high turnout among Latino voters towards Donald Trump this year. Some would call it blame. He says he has lost friends and even some family won't talk to him now. However, he adds that it was worth it. Reading is more than 70% Latino. Donald Trump won 36% of the vote here in 2020. This year, he won nearly 54% of the vote after he visited twice. Kelvin Rodriguez owns a used car lot nearby and voted for Trump. He says he wants to see lower taxes on his business, but the Catholic is particularly concerned about the role gender identity has played in this election. He doesn't like what he says his preteen children are exposed to in school.
We need to keep it how it is, you know, men's and women's and not different stuff like that. You know, I don't want to get into it because everybody, you know, think different. But I think we've got to follow what God said. You know what I mean?
Rodriguez, who grew up in Puerto Rico, says he wasn't bothered by what Trump has had to say about Hispanics in the country.
He's a strong guy. I don't know his attitude, like how he is. And, you know, he say what he got to say and he don't mind what people think about it. And I love that. You know, he say what he got to say. You know, that's why I like it.
It's lunchtime in Old San Juan Cafe here in Reading. This is where Kamala Harris made a surprise visit just a day before the election. Kellery Ortiz Rivera was there behind the counter.
I feel a little bit nervous and excited, and I meet her, yeah.
She now expresses disappointment by the outcome of the election.
Me siento un poco.
I feel a little confused and sad because I know that a lot of people supported Kamala, and it did not happen. Her win did not happen.
Ortiz Rivera, who was originally from Puerto Rico, was excited to vote for the first woman president. And she says she is now concerned about her young son's future.
Pues tengo un hijo. I have a son.
I have a son, and I would like for him to be raised in a better society with a better economy and better rights.
Walking around this neighborhood finds dozens of Harris wall signs strewn about, as well as Democrats who are reticent to talk about last week's results. However, down the road at Encanto Bakery and Grocery, Kevin Luna is willing to talk about his surprise.
I can't believe that a convicted felon like Donald Trump actually got reelected.
However, Luna says he expects Trump will get the economy back on track.
The only thing I don't like about him is the immigration part of it that he believes in. That's the only part I don't like about him. And then I voted for Kamala this time because I wanted someone different, and I wanted to see a woman run it to see what happens.
According to exit polling, Trump saw more than a 10-point increase among Latino voters nationally. For NPR News, I'm Carmen Russell-Suchansky in Reading, Pennsylvania.
Support for NPR's elections coverage comes from Sattva, committed to making handcrafted mattresses that help lull people to sleep and keep them sleeping soundly. More information is at SAATVA.com/NPR. And from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts.
Veterans across the U.S. have often voiced that they need support, whether that's help applying for benefits, receiving mental health services, or finding community with others. WFAE's Nick De La Canal takes us to the town of Mooresville, North Carolina, where a local coffee shop has become an unlikely place for veterans to receive all those things and much more.
A man pours coffee into a styrofoam cup on a busy morning inside Richard's Coffee Shop. Men and women wearing caps with military insignias sip drinks and eat biscuits. Around them, newspapers, photos, maps, and flags cover the walls.
Well, there's some spaces over here where pictures taken down.
Jack Wales and Butch Fogg finish their meal and hoist a heavy framed document into an empty space on the wall.
It's the charter for the VFW.
Yeah, this is our charter.
They say a friend who often drank coffee with them recently died, and they reprinted the charter to include his name.
Thank you.
My pleasure, brother. My pleasure.
Appreciate it.
It now hangs beside thousands of artifacts filling more than 8 rooms. There are helmets, medals, and uniforms from World War I through the war in Afghanistan. In one room hangs a portrait of a man with piercing blue eyes and a white mustache.
He's the one that started this whole museum.
His name was Richard Warren. He was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam who opened this shop in part to create a community for veterans he felt weren't getting help from the government. Herman Bullard, also a Vietnam vet, met Warren in 1995.
Everybody that came through the door, he wanted to know them. And if they were a veteran, he really wanted to know them. And he wanted to welcome them home.
At the time, the shop was named for Warren's wife, Pat, in a building across the street. When he died in 2009, his patrons, including Bullard, raised money to move the shop and carry on his mission of giving veterans space to meet and help each other.
Not only for me personally, but a lot of veterans would probably not be here today if it hadn't been for this coffee shop.
Every Thursday, there's free coffee for service members and volunteers to help them apply for benefits. Patrons also take up collections to help veterans pay for cars, homes, and utilities. Veterans like Tim Girard keep coming back for the fellowship.
For some of these guys, it's hard to open up and get in the weeds about certain things, where when they're sitting across the table talking to somebody that's served, they're a little more at peace and it's easier for them to talk to these guys.
Girard discovered Richards in 2022 when he was struggling with his mental health. On one of his first visits, a patron suggested he get a service dog.
Within a week of talking to somebody and then coming, I had a pup, a 9-week-old little girl named Maggie.
He says bringing that yellow American Lab home changed his life.
Having her, absolutely, makes a huge difference.
And he's been coming back ever since. He even brought his own artifact to the shop, an American flag flown at the tomb of the unknown soldier folded in a display box.
It's sitting on the table right underneath the picture.
He left it under a screen showing pictures of customers who've died. It's his own small tribute to the people who built this place for veterans in need of company, conversation, or a hot cup of coffee. For NPR News, I'm Nick Della Canal in Mooresville, North Carolina.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Volunteers are trained and ready to interview local veterans and service members for United Way of Northeastern Minnesota's Operation Service Stories Project. Interviews will be transcribed and archived. Learn more at UnitedWayNEMN.org/history. Now for the Up North Report.
For KAXC News, I'm Megan Buffington with a special edition of the Up North Report. Last year, Minnesota amended its renewable energy standard. The law requires electric utilities to use 55% renewable energy like wind and solar by 2035. By 2040, electricity generation must be completely carbon-free, which also includes sources like hydroelectric, hydrogen, and biomass. The Center for Rural Affairs is a Nebraska-based policy institute. It says Minnesota has the potential to take advantage of steady growth in industries like solar. But first, changes need to be made to the state's energy transmission system.
We're thinking about our transmission system like a highway for electricity, moving our power from where it's produced to the cities and communities that are needing it.
Cora Hoffer is a clean energy policy associate based in Minnesota for the center. She hopes two new fact sheets from the Policy Center focused on transmission and solar energy will help people understand where we are at in the clean energy transition, as well as the opportunities and challenges ahead.
I think Minnesota is in a really great position. We've had some monumental energy bills, climate bills over the last few sessions. So I think we are setting ourselves up, but I think there is still some challenges that exist within that. There's a big challenge we're facing with limited capacity on our electric grid, as well as permitting delays, which is slowing the pace of installing renewable energy projects like wind and solar. So this inadequate transmission capacity makes it really difficult to connect new renewable energy projects and also increases the cost of power that's being delivered onto our system. But there's some great opportunities that we could take advantage of through investing in our transmission system and also addressing those permitting delays. Minnesota will be able to tap into the economic and environmental benefits that renewable energy industry offers. This is including creation of jobs, also allowing for the development of renewable energy projects to bring cost-effective, reliable, and also affordable energy onto our grid. And then in addition, tying back in that policy aspect, when we're thinking about this in the context of Minnesota's 100% clean electricity by 2040 law, we're going to need the capacity on our electric grid to allow for the connections of renewable energy projects. That's going to help support the state's new mandate working towards that.
When Minnesota Power announced its new Boswell solar project in Cohasset back in September, the company said the new project was expected to be online by mid-2027, but it noted construction is contingent on regulatory approvals.
Last Minnesota State legislative session, there was a permitting reform bill passed, and its purpose was to help remove some of the barriers that were within the former permitting process to help cut down on those timelines. I think it's also just with that playing the game of like catch up and getting these projects through, but also tied to that is the transmission capacity issue. Like we don't have enough room on our electric grid to get all these projects online. So that permitting process delays combined with our capacity constraints, they're really like playing together in order to get these systems online.
Hoffer says if these challenges aren't addressed, Minnesota won't meet its clean energy goals.
As of right now, like we need more capacity within our system to, you know, tie in those new renewable energy projects to reach those goals. So if we're not addressing these issues, I don't think we're going to, or the state has the ability to reach those goals we have set.
That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The price of Bitcoin hit another record high today as cryptocurrency investors continue celebrating the results of last week's elections. The crypto industry was the biggest corporate donor to this year's campaigns for the White House and Congress, and the candidates it backed won big, including President-elect Donald Trump. One prominent crypto CEO called the election a huge win for the industry. That's a far cry from where it was just a couple years ago. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen is here to explain what this victory means for the rest of us. Hey, Maria.
Hey, Ari.
Trump embraced crypto throughout his campaign. What did he promise the industry?
He made some pretty grandiose promises, like this one in July.
This afternoon, I'm laying out my plan to ensure that the United States will be the crypto capital of the planet and the Bitcoin superpower of the world, and we'll get it done.
More specifically, he's also promised to fire Gary Gensler, the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Gensler is public enemy number one for most crypto investors and executives. And that's because the SEC under Gensler has cracked down on crypto companies for fraud and scams and money laundering. In some cases, the SEC has helped jail executives and fine companies billions of dollars. Now, Trump won't technically have the authority to fire Gensler, but it's safe to say that the industry expects a much friendlier government in January.
And what would a friendlier government environment for crypto mean for the rest of us?
Yeah, that is the $100 million question, Ari. Crypto executives and investors say this is a win for everybody. The industry says crypto is an alternative investment that will expand financial access, and certainly this election will help the industry go more mainstream. It'll also make it a lot easier for crypto companies to make money. And we should say that the people who could personally financially benefit include President-elect Trump, whose family launched a crypto business this fall. But consumer advocates are sounding the alarm about what this could all mean for the rest of us. Crypto's been used in a lot of illegal and just plain shady activities. I talked to Dennis Kelleher, the head of the nonpartisan watchdog Better Markets. He points out that with Republicans controlling the White House and likely Congress, there just won't be as many guardrails on the crypto industry.
And unfortunately, that means more scams, frauds, and criminals running amok, with those regulators and prosecutors mostly ignoring it all.
Kelleher also points out that whatever your feelings on crypto, there's not a lot of evidence that it's why people voted the way they did. Many of the campaign ads the crypto industry bought didn't even mention crypto. They highlighted other issues to help get crypto-friendly lawmakers elected.
Right. I mean, it wasn't just Trump who was elected. This presidential race included a race for Congress as well, which was a huge win for crypto. What other election results is the industry elated about?
Crypto PACs poured millions into congressional races across the country, and they're really excited about the results. One big victory was defeating Ohio Democrat Sherrod Brown, the chair of the Senate Banking Committee. He's been a real influential voice on financial regulation dating back to the 2008 financial crisis, but he's also a longtime critic of crypto. The industry spent tens of millions of dollars on the campaign of his opponent, and now crypto is going to have a friendly senator in Ohio. The industry overall is sending a message to other lawmakers. Crypto has the money to help end your political career, and they're willing to do it.
That's NPR's Maria Aspen. Thank you.
Thank you.
The transitional government in Haiti has fired its transitional prime minister, and a new leader was sworn in today. The ousted transitional prime minister is saying this is unconstitutional and he's not going anywhere. NPR's Eder Peralta is following the story from his base in Mexico City. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Eder, start by just telling us, how did we get here?
I mean, it's been brewing for a little bit. Some of the members of the council have been accused of corruption, and there's been disagreement about what exactly to do with them. And there's also been personal animosity between the members of the Transitional Council and the old Prime Minister. And then there's the part that actually matters. This council has been in power for about 6 months, and they are in control of a Kenyan-led international security force. But in part, because of this infighting, they've been paralyzed. They've done very little to bring order to the country. In fact, in the past few months, the gangs that forced another prime minister to resign have actually taken over more territory, and now this transitional government, which was supposed to stop the chaos, is actually adding to the turmoil. This weekend, a majority of the transitional council voted to oust the prime minister, but Prime Minister Gary Conille says the only one who can fire a prime minister in Haiti is parliament. And of course, at the moment, Haiti doesn't have a parliament. Either way, a new prime minister, a businessman named Alex Didier Feasmi, was sworn in, and he promised to re-establish security in Haiti.
Interesting. Okay, so clearly there's a big power struggle here. Mm-hmm. Do we have a sense of what could happen next?
You know, I called Robert Faton, who studies Haiti at the University of Virginia, and he says he has no idea. It's the first time he has no idea. He says Haiti effectively has no constitution. It's unclear who the police, the Kenyan forces, or even what's left of the military will listen to. But Faton says this is a reminder that Haiti's political and economic elites are, quote, bankrupt.
After each crisis, I always thought that the country had reached bottom, and that some sense would come out of that sense that things were really falling apart. But that has not happened. So I don't see why this would be any different, unfortunately.
And he says when the international community put together this transitional government, they relied on many of the same people who had engineered chaos in Haiti before. So Faton says it's unrealistic to appoint the same old people and expect a different result.
Eder, we have also been hearing reports of renewed violence in Port-au-Prince. What do you know about that?
It's been a really bad day. Local news are reporting that gangs are rampaging through Port-au-Prince, that houses have been burned and people killed. And at the same time, at the airport, a Spirit Airlines plane from Fort Lauderdale was likely hit by gunfire. A flight attendant suffered minor injuries and the plane was diverted to the Dominican Republic. And this is exactly the worry, that gangs will continue to be emboldened by a government that seems incapable of taking control of the country. And what we shouldn't forget is that this is devastating to regular Haitians. The UN put out new numbers last week, and they say that this year alone, almost 5,000 Haitians have been killed. 700,000 have had to flee their homes. And right now, humanitarian agencies say they're starting to see pockets of famine. So for the people of Haiti, this is dire.
NPR's Eder Peralta in Mexico City. Eder, thank you.
Thank you, Juana.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Last night, hit TV drama Yellowstone returned to the Paramount Network with a new episode after nearly 2 years away, and it was a crucial one, expected to reveal how they were going to write off the show's longtime star Oscar winner Kevin Costner. And heads up for everyone, we're going to talk about what happens to Costner's character John Dutton for the next couple minutes. The episode opened with a swarm of police inside Dutton's home. Here is his daughter Beth, played by Kelly Riley.
It's my father!
We can't have anyone on the inside of the house until detectives give us approval.
Why are there detectives in the house? Is this a crime scene? Is that what you're saying?
Well, that does not sound good. Here to talk about the fate of Costner's John Dutton and its impact on the Yellowstone universe is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hey there.
Hi.
So, Eric, Yellowstone was the most watched show on TV when this fifth season started 2 years ago. Can you just describe the show a little bit for those who maybe don't know it well?
Sure. So it's a drama centered on the family that owns the largest ranch in Montana, the Yellowstone Dutton Ranch. And Kevin Costner's character, John Dutton, is this tough patriarch who heads the family and will do anything to preserve that ranch. Now, earlier in the fifth season, which was split into two parts, Dutton became governor of Montana, but his adopted son, Jamie, wanted the job, and that kind of put them at odds.
Got it. So it seems like it's a bit of a shock for the second half of the season to start this way.
Yeah, I mean, we learned that Dutton is dead within the first 5 minutes of the episode. Now, it looks like he died of a self-inflicted gunshot, but anyone who knows John Dutton knows he likely wouldn't kill himself. And in a previous episode, we had seen Jamie talking about the possibility of really pushing back against his father, which Beth immediately suspects. So this kind of feels like a modernized version of that classic soap opera Dallas, in a way, you know, with a high-powered family going to war inside itself, with the fate of the ranch and maybe of Montana hanging in the balance.
I mean, Eric, given just how popular Yellowstone is, why is a big star like Kevin Costner leaving now, we should note, in the middle of the season?
Well, that is a complicated Hollywood story. So Yellowstone's fifth season debuted in 2022, and the second half was delayed by the writers and actor strikes. But there was also this tension between Costner and the show's co-creator slash showrunner, Taylor Sheridan. Now, Costner was trying to balance Yellowstone with his work on Horizon, this planned trio of Western films. But Costner eventually announced that he would not return for the second half of the season, and Sheridan had to figure out how to write him out.
Got it. So how will losing Costner's John Dutton affect the future of Yellowstone?
Well, it's tough to tell from this first episode, which flashbacks 6 weeks to capture cowboys working for the Yellowstone Dutton Ranch, moving livestock to Texas. Now, Yellowstone is often at its most affecting when it's capturing its working class cowboy heroes standing up for a way of life that they love, but they fear it's under threat. And I think that's another reason why this show sometimes feels like prestige TV for red states, elevating tradition while echoing concerns that those traditions might be destroyed by outside forces. Now, it might be tough for Yellowstone to carry on without Kevin Costner, but I think the audience's love for these characters, the culture, and that message, along with Sheridan's bold storytelling, just might keep the Yellowstone universe popular for quite a while.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks as always.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, offering opportunities in the tap room all season long for holiday shopping and gathering. Find out more about pop-up shops, rentals, events, and more on Facebook. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. And KXE's Board of Directors is holding an online auction going on until 8 o'clock tonight. Bid on baskets, books, experiences, and more. Find a link at kaxe.org. Programming on KAXE is supported in part by Jennifer Ivanza Insurance, an official MinSure partner. It's open enrollment season, and Jennifer Ivanza Insurance is here to support the Chisholm and Hibbing communities with health plan enrollment and guidance. More information available by calling 218-254-3422 or by visiting thenetworkmn.com. The Bemidji Public Library hosts a book club the second Monday of each month at noon. However, the November meeting will be Tuesday, November 12th, due to the Veterans Day holiday. This month's book is Fourth Wing by Rebecca Yaros, and the December 9th meeting will be about your favorite winter or holiday-themed book. We receive support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Central Lakes College Music Department presents its fall concert, Rhythm is Going to Get You, tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Chalberg Theater on the Brainerd campus. The National Alliance on Mental Illness presents a free Hope for Recovery workshop Wednesday, November 13th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Mesabi Unitarian Church in Virginia. It is designed for loved ones and those living with mental illness. It will include discussion and interactive exercises, plus support and connection among peers. And an MS support group meets at the I Am Hotel in Grand Rapids on the second Thursday of each month from 11 to 12:30.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. 13 states will have women governors next year, a record set after Republican Kelly Ayotte won the governor's race in New Hampshire last week. Her victory builds on the historic gains made during the 2022 elections, NPR's Juliana Kim reports.
The crowd chanted Republican Kelly Ayotte's name during her victory speech last Tuesday.
Tonight's victory is a victory for New Hampshire, but it's also a victory for an even brighter future for the greatest state in the nation.
Her win adds to the record set in 2022, when 12 women were elected to lead their states. Before that, the record had stood unbroken for nearly two decades. Kelly Dittmar is the Director of Research at Rutgers University's Center for American Women and Politics. She says while the new record is a milestone, there's still more progress to be made.
Women will be 26% of all the voters in 2025. That's going to be a new high, but there are still 18 states that have never elected a woman governor.
Two of them are Missouri and Indiana. They held governor races this year with women candidates, but they both lost. Dittmar says when women are elected into office, it tends to promote more trust in government.
One is about fairness and legitimacy in a representative democracy.
The second, she says, is that seeing women in office sends a positive message to young women that they can be in political leadership too.
And for young men, will they see that and hold less biases about who can and should be in elected leadership?
Women in office are far from monolithic in their positions or priorities, but they've often paved the way in raising issues that affect women around caregiving, including women in medical research, and improving how women are treated in the military. Those gains coincide with Vice President Harris's unsuccessful run to become the first female president. Had she won, Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan would have taken over as governor for vice presidential candidate Tim Walz. That would have made her the first indigenous woman to serve as governor in the U.S. Juliana Kim, NPR News.
The fall bird migration is winding down, and as the traveling birds cross the United States, many of them stopped at wetlands. Chances are they saw areas dominated by a tall reed with a big, fluffy seed head at the top. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has this report on why this particular plant makes lots of people shudder.
It's called Phragmites, an enormous non-native reed. You've surely seen it, like along the edge of highways, but have you ever tried to walk through it? I did, in Utah.
It's just like, ugh, trying to work my way through here is just almost impossible.
So Phragmites is actually one of the most problematic invasive species in wetlands across North America. And it's a problem because it's so incredibly dense and tall.
Karin Kettenring is an ecologist with Utah State University. She says this reed came to the U.S. more than 100 years ago.
It was used as packing material, the original styrofoam. You saw those big puffy seed heads, and they were probably used in shipping.
Once it takes hold, it spreads, crowding everything else out.
It's problematic in the Chesapeake Bay and Maryland. In the upper Midwest, where we have a huge amount of wetlands in Minnesota and Illinois and, you know, throughout that whole area.
It's bad in California and, of course, in Utah, where she works, and where marshes are literally an oasis in the desert for migrating birds. She says what birds want is a diverse habitat with different kinds of seeds and bugs to munch on. Not endless Phragmites. So land managers spend lots of time and money to battle it back. The trouble is, it has this really deep and complicated root system.
And to be able to reach that when you're trying to kill the plant, the only way to get down there is herbicide.
That means poisoning vast areas of wetlands, leaving tons of dead stalks that have to be burned or mowed. What's left is a blank slate of mud,
which is the perfect habitat for Phragmites to come right back in.
She says what's really needed is research to figure out how to quickly get native plants back in there. I joined her team as they visited some experimental plots in Utah's Howard Slough Waterfowl Management Area. This huge marsh is next to the Great Salt Lake. It's crisscrossed with water channels and dikes. We drive on top of those dikes through a world of Phragmites, passing waterways filled with ducks, egrets, a heron. When the car stops, we put on waders. I can tell this is going to be fun. We muck across a muddy field to reach their experiments.
This area has been treated for multiple years for Phragmites management.
Haley Macnikowski is a graduate student. She says getting seeds to take root and grow is hard when water conditions can change a lot.
You would think with a wetland and water being the defining feature that you can plan to have consistent water when we find that that's not the case.
So she scattered seeds from more than 20 native species. You can't buy this seed mix in a store. The researchers had to gather them by hand from wild plants, ranging from ones that like to grow up out of the water to ones that are resistant to drought.
Basically hoping that something within that mix is going to match what the conditions are, so you'll have some native vegetation reestablishing regardless of what the hydrologic conditions are.
Normally, when land managers try to reseed wetlands, they might use like 5 kinds of seeds. Plus, they typically put out seed in the spring. Montana Horchler has been testing the effect of seeding the ground in the late summer and fall, too.
So every 2 weeks, we come out here and we do visual estimations of cover by species.
Some seeds they've tried have been a bust, but others are doing surprisingly well, like a native plant called pickleweed. Also a type of beggar tick with bright yellow flowers. Later on, Karin Kettenring told me that restoration efforts at this site give her some hope that recovery after Phragmites is possible.
For the first time, we were seeing a much higher diversity of native species reestablishing. We literally had not ever achieved that before.
This is just one small place. Scaling up what they're trying in Utah would be a challenge, like getting growers to produce all the seeds needed for various parts of the country. Still, she thinks this approach is the way forward, because as satisfying as it may be, killing Phragmites is just the start of restoring native habitats for the birds. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, arm.com. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Khmer Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text or donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. The 44th Annual Community Thanksgiving Dinner in Bemidji is on Thursday, November 28th. If you would like a meal delivered to you, you may put in your request by Monday, November 25th at noon. There are also opportunities for volunteering, and monetary donations are welcome. Call KAXE for more information at 218-326-3900.